Good morning. Our first case this morning is United States against Lewis. Counsel for the appellant, you may proceed.
Good morning, members of the court. It's a pleasure to be back before the court. Chief Judge Efron, it's a little bit colder than the last time that I appeared here before the court, but members of the court, we're here for really a very limited purpose, but this is a very important case, obviously. And the appellant's position in this case is clear, that the military judge committed plain error when she allowed the trial counsel to ask a defense expert witness whether he found anything exculpatory to the accused and whether he found anything to indicate someone other than the accused was the perpetrator of this crime. These questions, combined with the trial counsel's rebuttal argument and the military judge's questioning of a defense expert, impermissibly implied to the members that the accused had the burden of proving he did not commit these offenses. And what I'd like to do, Your Honor, is to start with a quick analysis of what happened in this case, discuss United States v. Mason and Hayes v. State. As you know, members of the court, the trial counsel essentially asked two questions of an expert witness in this case. In essence, those two questions were this. One, did you find anything that you personally considered exculpatory to the accused when you conducted an examination of the crime scene evidence in this case? And two, you didn't find anything to make you personally think that anyone besides the appellant was a shooter in this case. These questions did two things, both of which the appellant argues were impermissible. One, they shifted the burden of proof to the appellant to prove that he did not commit these heinous crimes. And two, they asked the expert his personal opinion on the ultimate conclusion before the members.
Counsel, why didn't defense open the door to this in Joint Appendix 40 when he said, we are going to prove to you that Specialist Lewis did not commit these offenses. We are going to prove to you that he's not guilty because, one, all the witnesses are liars, and two, the police work was sloppy. Well, and the questions, of course, dealt with the sloppy police work.
I think it's important, Your Honor, and I think that's exactly what U.S. v. Mason talks about and Hayes v. State. And I think it's important, Your Honor, to look at the context of what the counsel was stating in his opening statement, which is, we're going to prove to you that he didn't do it because this evidence is so messed up. He did not do anything, as Hayes v. State points out, in a very important distinction, which affirmatively shifted the burden of proof for him to put on any evidence. And what Hayes v. State and Mason...
No, but isn't the... And the judge made that clear. But isn't the government entitled to comment on what the defense puts in? And how did this go beyond the boundaries of what the defense counsel said he was going to do?
Let me answer those questions one at a time, Judge.
Yeah.
As far as what the government could have done, I think what the government could have done, as both Hayes and Mason and I think Webb tell them.
And why should we look to Hayes for anything?
Well, I think Hayes is extremely important for this case because it is the closest case to on point and because Mason cites to Hayes. But in terms of your question about what could the government have done or what should the government have done, I think the answer to that is really quite simple. The government is entitled to put its expert back on the stand and say, you heard Mr. Peck's testimony. Did you do X? If you did not do X, why did you not do it? And then the government expert can explain, we did not do this because we did not feel that there was any reason for us to do it or whatever reason the government expert would have had. But the important distinction, Your Honor, is that nowhere in the appellant's case did they do anything that asserted that they had the burden. In other words, it's not like the cases cited by the government, which, and this answers, I hope answers the second one of your questions, it is not like those questions cited by the government in which the appellant, through counsel, made an affirmative representation that they were going to put on an affirmative defense. And I think that is the important distinction as to why this case went beyond those bounds.
Now, this trial counsel's questions that you just cited come in the context of a number of questions, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And don't those questions, taken as a whole, go to the defense theory that the investigation was not thorough? The questions taken as a whole, right?
Yes, sir.
So why aren't these questions viewed in that context rather than pulled out in isolation? There's no question, in my view at least, that if you just say, well, did you find anything exculpatory, that tells you one thing. But if the question before and the question after is, how thorough was the investigation? Did you find anything like this? Did you find it? Why isn't that just a series of questions about ferocity?
Because the purpose of the defense investigator in this case is not to prove that the appellant did not do something. The purpose of a defense investigator in this case is to show the shortcomings in the government case. And for the government to say, well, you saw that this happened, it's certainly permissible when the government said you knew that Lewis had made, allegedly made incriminating statements to three of his individuals, did you consider that? Those are entirely appropriate questions. But when you cross that threshold into saying, did you find anything that you found exculpatory? Well, the defense expert has no reason to find anything that's exculpatory. That's not what he's doing. What he is doing is examining the government's case to see whether or not they can meet their burden.
Which of the three instances, there's more than one comment, but which of the three, trial counsel direct, military judge question, or the rebuttal statement by counsel, do you think is the most problematic?
Well, I would think
first as a matter of law, then as a matter of prejudice.
I'm sorry, I didn't catch the last part.
First as a matter of law, and then as a matter of prejudice, and you may have the same answer.
Sure. I would think, Your Honor, that the rebuttal argument is the most egregious for two reasons. One, in contradiction of this court's edict in U.S. v. Moran, the trial counsel misstated the evidence during his closing argument and when he did the summation of what Mr. Peck allegedly testified to. But two, because of the timing, that is the last thing that the court hears from any party in this case, it's going to be the thing that sticks with them the most. So I would think that addresses both the legal and the harmlessness issue as far as why that was the most egregious of the arguments.
And are we dealing there with a plain error or an injected error?
Well, I think, Your Honor, it's actually interesting. I think that there's sort of a hybrid here. I think as it relates to the questions asked by the trial counsel and the rebuttal argument, we're dealing with plain error. As with regards to the member's question that the military judge expanded upon slightly, I would actually argue that we're dealing with a abuse of discretion, because even though the defense counsel didn't object, the military judge had stated at the beginning, you can't object to my questions. So as to that small portion of it, I think we're dealing with an abuse of discretion. But the defense would certainly admit, and appellant admits, that as to the rest of the issues, we are dealing with a plain error analysis.
Now, with respect to the scope of the cross-examination of the witness here, if the defense contends that a investigation was incompetent or incomplete, does that reasonably raise in the minds of the panel members a number of things? First, did they look for other people? Secondly, did they look for information that would be exculpatory towards the accused? That is that not something we would expect a reasonable jury or a reasonable panel would expect police to do, and that is not simply go after someone, but also determine whether there might be evidence that would constitute exculpatory evidence for them.
Yes, sir.
And so if that's reasonable for panel members to anticipate that that's within the scope of a competent investigation, is it permissible for the opposing party on cross-examination to inquire as to whether the investigation looked for exculpatory information?
No, and let me tell you why, Judge. I think it's entirely permissible, as I stated in response to Judge Stuckey's question. If the government wants to put their investigator back on the stand to say, why did you not do these things? I think U.S. v. Mason clearly states that that's permissible. And I think, it's a footnote in Mason, but at one point in Mason, this court says that's the preferred way to do it. You put the government expert back on and say, why didn't you do it? But when you do that towards the defense investigator, what you have essentially done, and what we argue in this case, is that you've now told the panel they didn't find anything exculpatory, shifting the burden to the defense to prove that he didn't do it.
Now, do we have here a defense investigator who is investigating the underlying incident, or do we have a defense expert who's commenting on the quality of the government's investigation?
Well, certainly, as you read the packet, he's appointed as a defense expert. He then becomes a defense expert. I think it's clear that the purpose of this expert was to say, I've looked at this investigation. They did not do a thorough investigation. Therefore, the data or the evidence in this case is unreliable.
I understand that. So that goes back to my initial question. If the purpose of the witness was to talk about the quality of the government's investigation as opposed to doing strictly an independent investigation of the evidence.
Yes, sir.
why is it impermissible to cross-examine that person on questions that panel members are reasonably likely to ask about the quality of the investigation? That is, if the members are reasonably likely to wonder whether there was exculpatory evidence examined, why can't that be a subject of cross-examination?
Well, I think it's perfectly appropriate, Your Honor, for the court to say, for the government to point out that as you're criticizing this investigation, did you consider these things? As I said, the fact that he had allegedly made statements to others, the fact that it was allegedly his weapon, and that would show, and the fact that trial counsel did show other areas in which the investigation, in their opinion, was quite thorough. But it is certainly not permissible because, going to the heart of your question, because when you ask the question, did you find anything that was exculpatory to the accused, that's not his job. That's not why he is there. He is there solely to comment upon the quality of the investigation. And I think it's an important distinction, Your Honor, that the government misses in this case, which is the question is not whether or not the accused can prove somebody else did this crime. The question is whether or not the government can prove that he did it beyond a reasonable doubt. Now, Your Honors, moving to the rebuttal argument in this case, I would like to point out a couple of things as stated previously in response to Judge Efron's question. The trial counsel states, in contradiction of this court's edict in U.S. v. Moran, that Mr. Pex was looking for anything exculpatory. That was not correct. That was not his job, and that is not what he was doing. And they also said that he did not find anything to show that anybody else but the accused was the shooter in this case. Well, that's not what he said. The government theme in this case was constant. The appellant could not prove that he did not do it. That was the purpose of the three questions to Mr. Pex and the purpose of the rebuttal argument in this case. In doing so, the government shifted the burden of proof to the defense and suggested to the members that the accused had the burden to provide exculpatory evidence. I'd now like to move this court to a quick discussion of the plain error argument, subject to any questions from the court. The military judge, we believe, had a sua sponte responsibility to stop these questions and to not expand upon the questions during her questioning of Mr. Pex. In so doing, she violated United States v. Mason. And I think it's important when looking at Mason, Your Honors, for this court to remember that this court found it improper to ask if either party has requested DNA testing. And this court found error in those questions. Well, the appellant would submit that if it's error to ask if either party had done something to retest or to take a second look at the evidence in the case, it is certainly error to ask if the accused expert found anything to prove that he did not commit these offenses. Clearly, it was the purpose of the government's questioning was to leave the panel with the thought that if the defense expert had any evidence that the accused was innocent, he would have brought it forward. This is fundamentally contrary to our system of justice under the military justice system. And it is akin to Hayes v. State, cited in U.S. v. Mason. As the court noted in Hayes, the accused made no claim upon which he bore the burden of proof. And as in Hayes, the trial counsel made great use of this failure to provide exculpatory evidence in his closing argument. That is the distinction between Hayes v. State and U.S. v. Mason. In U.S. v. Mason, this court did not find plain error and found it harmless, or found plain error, but found it harmless beyond a reasonable doubt because of two things. They said that, one, the overwhelming quality of the DNA evidence, and two, the fact that the prosecutor did not make any use of that evidence or that argument during his closing. In this case, he did, and he pounded it into the panel. The focus of the defense case here was that the investigation was flawed and focused on appellant exclusively. Therefore, the investigators failed to investigate other leads and look at other evidence. That is the gravamen of the problem in this case, Your Honor. It is fundamentally different from those cases cited by the government where the accused promised a certain witness or proffered a certain defense, a certain affirmative defense, and failed to deliver. And I would also point this court's attention back to two cases cited by the government, two cases from this court, U.S. v. Carter and U.S. v. Grandy, in which in both of those cases, this court found that a curative instruction by the military judge was insufficient to overcome the taint based on the improper comments by the trial counsel. The errors in this case were not harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. This is not the Mason case, where the only question is whether or not that qualitative number that comes from a DNA expert goes from 1 in 250 billion to 1 in 150 billion or something like that. And also in Mason, where the trial counsel specifically distanced himself from any impression that may have been left with the panel that the burden of proof had shifted to the accused. Here the trial counsel jumped on the prior statements and expounded upon them. This was a very close case, Your Honors. The evidence of the accused guilt was by no means overwhelming. When the panel is left with an impression that if the appellant had not committed these crimes, he would have brought forth evidence to prove that he did not did it, that impermissibly shifts the burden of proof to the appellant and should lead to a reversal of the charges in this case. Subject to any further questions of the court, that concludes my argument.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Judge.
Counsel for the government.
Chief Judge Efron, judges of the court, may it please the court, my name is Captain Madeline Yanford, and I, along with Major Chris Burgess, represent the United States in this matter. Trial counsel did not commit error and violate appellant's right to due process. Rather, trial counsel's cross-examination questions and rebuttal argument were an appropriate response to defense counsel's theory that the police investigation was unreliable and that this was affirmative evidence of appellant's innocence. Even if this court finds that error occurred, any such error was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. For these reasons, appellant's request for relief should be denied. In United States v. Webb, this court stated that it is well established that the government may comment on the failure of a defendant to refute government evidence or support its own claims. Further, this court also stated in United States v. Moran that this court examines prosecutorial comment within the context of the entire court's martial. This is not a case of plain and obvious error. In this case, trial counsel properly examined Mr. Peck's, cross-examined Mr. Peck's, to determine what he found after his own investigation of the crime scene that the local police did not find. Trial counsel properly challenged Mr. Peck's opinion of the investigation tactics of the local police. What opened the door to this line of questioning? The implication by Mr. Peck's testimony that the local police had missed evidence. This is further buttressed by Joint Appendix pages 76 and 77, in which Mr. Peck's answers to, in question to defense counsel, well, do we want to reflect on this particular case? What I would do, have done here, to which the defense counsel answers yes. Further, Mr. Peck then states, this is an overview and points to a PowerPoint slide that is titled, What Would I Do? Trial counsel's questions were focused on whether Mr. Peck found any evidence that would undermine the reliability of the investigation. This is distinguished from what could have been done, as was the case in United States versus Mason and Hayes versus State, versus an appellant's case, what had already been done. In appellant's case, the defense counsel had already hired an expert to survey the crime investigation scene and had put out there as a theory that the investigation focused on the appellant improperly to the exclusion of others. This was a focus, Mr. Peck's testimony specifically, on what deficiencies were found in the investigative process already conducted by the defense expert. Not that the appellant had the burden to prove anything, contrary to both Mason and Hayes. Appellant's case is readily distinguished by both of those cases. In United States versus Mason, the trial counsel improperly asked a government expert whether or not either party had requested a retest of the DNA evidence, improperly implying to the panel that the defense actually had some sort of obligation to request that retest. Further, in Hayes versus State, the prosecutor improperly asked if the defense counsel had requested a test of the physical evidence for bloodstains.
Why doesn't the military judge's question imply that the defendant had some duty to put something up?
Your Honor, the military judge asked a member question as to whether or not Mr. Peck had found anything of evidentiary significance, and for the same reason that the trial counsel's question was not improper, the military judge did not imply that the burden of proof shifted to the defense. Rather, Mr. Peck was testifying as to what deficiencies were in the police investigative process, and so the military judge properly asked, well, then what did Mr. Peck find in his own independent investigation of that same crime scene, and was there anything of evidentiary significance? Again, going back to defense's theory that the appellant was investigated to the exclusion of others. So the military judge's question within the context of the court's martial was in fact proper.
Did the expert testify as to what he investigated or what he would have done? And is that significant here?
Yes, Your Honor. Mr. Peck did testify as to what he would have done, and that is significant with regards to...
No, but was he also testifying as to an independent investigation? That is, was he asserting, I investigated this matter and did or did not find X?
Yes, Your Honor, he was doing both. He was not only making an assessment as to what should have been done, but also as to his examination of the crime investigation scene. For example, on Joint Appendix 77, Mr. Peck talks about how he would have secured the parking lot, divided it into two areas, and done line searches, something the local police had not done. He also referenced a Department of Justice standard operating procedure for crime scene analysis and mentioned that the local police investigators had, as a resource, a major crimes team to support local police investigators. They did not, in fact, have the manpower to handle the crime scene.
Did his testimony on direct suggest that he had investigated for exculpatory evidence?
Yes, Your Honor, it did, because, again, Mr. Pax went back to the investigation scene and in the direct examination by defense counsel explained various procedures that, in his expert opinion, should have been conducted at that crime scene.
And in what way did that raise the issue of exculpatory evidence as opposed to absence of evidence?
Your Honor, Mr. Pex's testimony, first, the fact that defense counsel called their own expert who was hired to re-examine the crime investigation scene opened the door as to whether or not...
I understand. Pardon me for interrupting, but I understand your argument opening the door. I'm asking a specific question, and that is, did the defense expert testify, or was he asked, whether he specifically looked for exculpatory information?
No, Your Honor, he was not specifically asked if he looked for exculpatory information.
And so then what is the theory upon which the cross-examination is allowed to ask about exculpatory information?
The theory, Your Honor, is that Mr. Pex went in to conduct a reinvestigation, and trial counsel appropriately asked in cross-examination, well, based on your investigation, what did you find? And that was framed within the context of what did you find at this crime scene that the local police did not find at that crime scene. And that's what was in the context of the trial counsel's cross-examination questions, what the heart of the matter was. If, in fact, the local police did not find particular items, what did you, in fact, find in your reinvestigation that the police may not have found? Further, trial counsel's rebuttal argument was an appropriate response on appellant's failure to support his own claims during closing. And again, the court should analyze this within the context of the rebuttal argument, which was in direct response to defense counsel's closing argument. In closing, defense counsel argued, but listen, I want to give you more, some affirmative evidence of innocence, because you see, I could just keep my mouth shut. The government's case has already failed. But we're going to go on the offense now and try to give you something to hang your hats on. We're going to give you affirmative evidence of innocence. The defense counsel continues to argue that they looked at Lewis in every discipline that they understand and found nothing. They did not look at these other folks. This is affirmative evidence of innocence. The evidence was transferred from that crime scene to the killer and was never found because it was never looked for in the right place. And concluded, Lewis was excluded by the forensic evidence.
Is it the direct testimony that opens the door to cross, or is it the trial counsel's opening argument that opens the door to cross?
With regards to Mr. Pex's cross-examination, Your Honor?
Cross.
The defense counsel's direct examination, as well as the reasons by which the defense expert was, in fact, called to testify, Your Honor.
So, just to be clear, is it the government's view that the cross is limited to what was asked, the scope of the direct examination? Is that the correct statement of law or not?
Yes, Your Honor.
So, to the extent that the defense counsel got up and promised the world, but the direct examination only brought the moon, the limit is the moon, right?
Yes, Your Honor. In rebuttal, contrary to appellant's assertions, trial counsel appropriately argued that the defense expert did not find anything that would support defense counsel's argument that appellant was excluded by the forensic evidence. Defense counsel first argued that appellant was excluded by the forensic evidence specifically because the local police looked in the wrong places. So trial counsel appropriately argued in rebuttal that despite their own expert looking in the right places, nothing was found. Third, even if this court finds any such error was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. First, the military judge's instructions were sufficient and cured any error associated with trial counsel's cross-examination and rebuttal argument. The military judge instructed on Joint Appendix 208 and 224, bear in mind that arguments of counsel are not evidence, and twice instructed on the burden of proof. First, at Joint Appendix 163, the military judge reminded the panel of the burden of proof prior to the defense's case in chief, and second, instructed the panel on the burden of proof again after the close of arguments on Joint Appendix 171. Further, the panel is presumed to understand and follow the military judge's instructions absent evidence to the contrary. And further, there is no case law to support appellant's contention that there should have been a tailored instruction. Instead, this is similar to United States versus Mason, in which this court determined that the error was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt and cited to the military judge's instructions at the close of arguments. And this is also distinguished from Hayes versus State, because in Hayes versus State, the court cited that the curative instruction was deficient because the judge improperly instructed the jury that while the defense had no obligation to test for blood stains, that they had an opportunity to do so. And the court was unwilling to assume that the jury could distinguish between those two terms. Additionally, during voir dire, each panel member indicated they understood that the defense has absolutely no obligation to present any evidence or disprove the elements of the offenses. And finally, contrary to appellant's argument on appeal, other evidence against appellant was strong. Appellant told three different people, all of whom testified at trial, that he murdered the two victims. Mr. Brown, one of the witnesses who testified, personally observed appellant commit the drive-by shooting. Appellant's six-hour handgun was used in both the murder and drive-by shooting, and appellant threw it into Puget Sound soon after the murders. And a witness's description of appellant's attire on the night of the murders matched the account of another witness who saw a person running from the crime scene. Therefore, direct evidence of the drive-by shooting and circumstantial evidence of murder was sufficient to convince the panel beyond a reasonable doubt of appellant's guilt. If there are no further questions, if I may briefly conclude. Trial counsel's cross-examination of Mr. Pex and his statements on rebuttal were not error. Even if this court finds error in trial counsel's conduct, any such error was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. This court should therefore deny appellant's requested relief. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Does the defense have rebuttal?
We do. I have an impressive collection of glasses down here. I'll clean up afterwards, Judge. Judge Efron, I'd like to start with the question that you posed, which is, what was the purpose of the defense expert? I think it's a crucial distinction in this case. The purpose of the defense expert was not to redo the criminal investigation to see whether there was anything to exculpate the accused. That is not what the defense expert is for. The defense expert is to look at the government's case and to see whether or not, based on that investigation, there are problems with that investigation which could lead a panel to not be convinced beyond a reasonable doubt of the appellant's guilt. Government counsel makes much about the distinction of the fact that Mason was a case not in what they could have done, but in terms of what they would have done. There is no such distinction in Mason. In Mason, what happened, as this court well knows, is that the appellant's counsel said, or the government counsel rather, said that either party asked for a retest. Well, that is both a case of what could have happened and what would have happened had the defense expert done something differently. That is exactly what occurred in this case. The military judge's question in response to Judge Baker's question was whether or not, certainly implied by stating, did you find anything of evidentiary significance? Well, certainly anything of evidentiary significance would include anything that exculpates the accused. And clearly implied to the panel members that when this defense expert, again going back to the chief judge's question, that when the defense expert was, quote, redoing the crime scene, which is not what he was doing, that he had found anything that would have exculpated the accused, that certainly the panel members would have seen it. That was not the purpose of the defense investigator in this case, nor was that the scope of the defense counsel's questioning of the defense expert during the direct examination. This is not a case in which the defense investigator said, well, when I was investigating this case, I found X. What he said was, when I was investigating the case, I found the following shortcomings in the government investigation of this case. He did not say, for example, obviously if he had found, Private Lambert's, let's say, hypothetical fingerprint in the Hurley McDowell vehicle, well, obviously that's something that could have been brought forth to the members. But that's not what the defense investigator was doing in this case. He was looking at the government investigation and pointing out to the members why that investigation improperly focused on the appellant to the exclusion of three very viable candidates for the killers in this case, and as a result, why that investigation was unreliable. And I would use a scientific analogy in which if you do incomplete research, your data is not going to hold up under peer review. In this case, if you do an incomplete investigation, the end result of that investigation does not prove the appellant's guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. But it is important to note, Your Honors, that what we are talking about here is not the addition of evidence, but the absence of evidence, that the government investigators did not do several things which could have led this investigation to go in another way. They did not send off other fingerprints to be tested, for example. They did not send off DNA of other experts to be of other witnesses, rather, to be tested. They did not do a search of the other three possible co-conspirators' clothing. All of these things were used by the defense investigator to point out to the panel that this investigation fell short of an objectively reasonable standard. He was not hired to do a reinvestigation of a crime scene to see if the appellant did not commit these horrible crimes. The accused was excluded by the forensic evidence in this case. That is what the defense counsel was referring to in their closing argument. There is not a shred of physical evidence that links appellant to these horrible crimes, and that is what the defense expert was referring to and what the defense counsel was referring to when he said that he would provide affirmative evidence of innocence. It is the absence of evidence.
That's not affirmative evidence.
Well, I certainly wouldn't have characterized it that way myself, Judge, but I think the clear implication of what the defense counsel was saying is we're going to prove to you that he didn't do it because they've got no evidence that he did. And he certainly never came out and said, we're going to prove to you that he didn't do it because, our expert found evidence that shows that. So while I would agree with you, Judge, maybe a little bit inartfully drafted, but I think the clear implication was that it was the absence of evidence to which he was referring. In closing, Your Honors, the subject to any further questions of the court, the comments by the trial counsel in his rebuttal and the questions by the trial counsel implied to the members that the appellant had the affirmative obligation to prove his innocence, shifted the burden of proof back to the defense, and as a result, this court should reverse the convictions. Thank you, members of the court.
Thank you, counsel. Thank counsel for both parties for your presentation today. The case is now submitted, and the court will be in recess until 5 minutes after 10 o'clock.
Court stands in recess until 10:05.